This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's the first day of April, a day for practical jokes and good poems. It's the third year that April has been designated National Poetry Month, and we're celebrating today with a great poet who we love to hear read out loud. Robert Hass was the U.S. Poet Laureate from 1995 to 97. Shortly after he began his term, he started a weekly syndicated column in the Washington Post called Poet's Choice. The idea was to make poetry accessible by getting it into the newspaper. Each week he would print a poem from a recent book by a poet that he admired, but once a month he would give himself the liberty of choosing an old poem he particularly liked. Now those columns are collected in his new book, Poet's Choice, Poems for Everyday Life. We invited Hass to read and talk about some of those poems. Let's start with one by Sharon Olds about being the mother of a newborn child. It's called Her First Week, and I'll let Robert Hass explain why he chose it.
One of the odd things about doing this book, which is a collection of the newspaper columns I did for the Post, was that I had... My agreement was with them was that 3 out of 4 of the poems that would appear weekly would be from new books. So, and then I quickly discovered something I hadn't thought about it when we decided to do this, and that was that they had to be poems under 40 lines long, because the, you know, to appear in syndication, the column had to have a sort of uniform length. So I started reading books in a new and not necessarily desirable way, which was I would look through books for poems that caught my eye that were the right length. But I was also trying to find poems about ordinary experiences, powerful poems about the common stuff of our lives. And she is above all a poet who does that. Her poems can be very painful and very funny, and the language is often sort of startling and visually intense. I also was, because I needed some principle of selection faced with a deadline and a bunch of books, I would, not religiously, but I would sort of try to pick poems that were somehow related to the time of year. So this was a poem about a baby's first week, and it was springtime, and it was the right length, and it had those other qualities. So, and I, you know, have known and admired her work for a long time. So this is called Her First Week. She was so small, I would scan the crib a half second to find her. Face down in a corner, limp as something gently flung down or fallen from some sky an inch above the mattress. I would tuck her arm along her side and slowly turn her over. She would tumble over part by part like a load of damp laundry in the dryer. I'd slip a hand in under her neck, slide the other under her back, and evenly lift her up. Her little bottom sat in my palm. Her chest contained the puckered moire sacks, and her neck, I was afraid of her neck. Once I almost thought I heard it quietly snap. I looked at her, and she swiveled her slate eyes and looked at me. It was in my care, the creature of her spine, like the first chordate, as if the history of the vertebrate had been placed in my hands. Every time I checked, she was still with us. Someday, there would be a human race. I could not see it in her eyes, but when I fed her, gathered her like a loose bouquet to my side, and offered the breast, grayish-white, and struck with minuscule scars like creaks in sunlight, I felt she was serious. I believed she was willing to stay.
I really like that, but having the responsibility for a newborn. Sharon Olds is
for
great.
The whole history of
the whole history of mankind, yeah. Sharon Olds is now the official poet of New York State.
Yes.
Yeah. So did you get a new sense of what people respond to in poems and what kind of scares people off in poems by reading a lot of poems out loud for people?
Well, I get a lot of mail from the readers of the poems in the column.
Yeah.
And I do get a sense of, I don't get a sense of what scares them off. I would, and I don't know if the people who are moved to write are a good sample, but it's not difficulty. In fact, if anything, it's dullness. I occasionally get indignant letters from people saying, how could you publish that poem? It's boring. The language is boring. And I think that the people responded to a range of poetry.
Now, there's one poem that you reprint in Poet's Choice that you also argue with, and this is a poem by the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, and you published this in part because of the popularity of the movie The Postman or Il Postino, in which Neruda is a character. The translation was by Stephen Mitchell, and I want to read the lines in question. This is a love poem about how much the writer loves somebody. Yeah.
It's a sonnet of Neruda's it's easier to rhyme in Spanish. It does sort of rhyme in Spanish. But it begins, I don't love you as if you were the salt rose, topaz, or arrow of carnations that propagate fire. I love you as certain dark things are loved, secretly between the shadow and the soul. And he goes on in this vein and says, I love you without knowing how or when or from where. I love you simply without problems or pride. I love you in this way because I don't know any other way of loving but this, in which there is no I or you, so intimate, so on.
And what do you think of that?
I think we all feel that way sometimes.
About ourselves, about how pure and selfless we are.
Yeah. I love you in this way because I don't know any other way of loving but this, in which there is no you or I. Neruda, is a very great poet. I mean, he's a completely amazing poet, but he also is very prolific and said a lot of things in his poems.
Well, you point out in your book that you believe that everyone knows how to be more crazy and more selfish and would be perfectly capable of being more crazy and selfish, and they're probably more crazy and selfish than they really think they are.
Yeah.
And how they love. And I'd have to agree with you in this.
Yeah, and that early stage of falling in love, with the incandescent feeling of your own purity that you briefly get is usually sort of disastrous as things play out.
But it's a very popular subject for poetry and for song lyrics.
Well, I was thinking about that. I mean, I was thinking about the difference between poetry and song lyrics during my reverie about my memory. For some reason, I was thinking about Shaboom, but it went Shaboom, Shaboom, yada-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Shaboom. Life could be a dream, sweetheart, if I could only take you up to paradise up above. If I could, you're the only one that I love. Life could be a dream, sweetheart. My head is full of lyrics like that, and I love them, and people love them. And life can't be a dream for very long, you know. And somehow, I was thinking about the way in which Shakespeare could still get away with songs like that. You know, it made me think that the equivalent of Shaboom was something like, and so it's springtime, the pretty, pretty ring time when birds do sing, hey, ding-a-ding-a-ding, sweet lovers love the spring. Hey, ding-a-ding-a-ding was the yada-da-da-da-da-da-da of the 16th century. And somehow, poetry as the serious art got to be responsible for saying the true thing, you know. Yeats said, we've fed our hearts on fantasy and our hearts grow brutal on the fair. That poetry doesn't get to be the place where you get to do the disastrous and pure emotion of the moment, but where you get the whole adult complexity. And of course, it's a loss in a certain way.
One of the poems that you include in your book, Poet's Choice, is a poem that has to do with the blues and with the form of blues songs.
Yeah.
And I thought this might be a good time to have you read that, since it's in a way a poem about songs.
It is. And it comes from a wonderful book. This book was published by the University of Akron Press. Very, very obscure university press. It's a pretty new book by a poet who I don't know anything about, named John Davis, from a book called Scrimmage of Appetite that I just love. And it's called Blues. And it's written in a kind of rhythmic prose paragraphs. So here's a couple of stanzas of Blues. The first line must be about heartbreak. Oh, she stomped my heart, give me the stompin' blues. The second must be the first sung with increased rage and despair. Yeah, she stomped my heart, give me the stompin' blues. The third must add detail and complete the breakage. She stomped it with my best friend, wore my favorite shoes. At this point, the guitar may complain or cry. At this point, the singer may moan, oh, baby. At this point, a white boy, a construction laborer in work boots and flannel shirt, may, having been overcome by the poignancy of the occasion and several draft beers, begin to sway and shout amen, thrusting his plastic cup into the air, which may or may not signal the coming of an avant-garde. Say the next time he shouts, radiator. Say the next time he shouts, come unto the Lord. Say the next time he shouts, I'm on fire. Or, stuff the turkey, the kids are in the car and I can't stay long. Say he talks over the bridge saying, the cake flopped. We gave it to the cousin who eats such things. And so on.
That's really good.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Now, have you written anything inspired by songs? Since there's so many song lyrics in your head.
Yeah. I don't know that there's anything I want to share. We once got into a competition to write a country western lyric, and not a parody of, but a serious one. And I had a try at it. And I go back and look at that poem every once in a while and think, well, it's not so bad, but I'm not sure I want to recite it. I think it was a California party on a starry summer night, and the band played country western, and the singing was all right, and so on.
So now you need a melodist. My guest is Robert Haas, former poet laureate of the U.S. His new book is called Poet's Choice, Poems for Everyday Life. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Haas. He's the former poet laureate. He has several collections of his own poems, but his new book is a collection of favorite poems by other writers, and that book is called Poet's Choice, Poems for Everyday Life. Well, you print another poem that's kind of a song, and it's a Keats poem called Daisy's Song. This is from 1818.
Yeah.
And is this actually written in a song form, do you think? Do you think he meant it to be a song?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that was happening in English poetry in 1818 was interest in a huge range of song forms. The first big collections of English and Scottish folk songs were appearing in that same movement of collecting that produced Grimm's Fairy Tales and eventually led Americans, scholars, to get interested in the lyrics of the work song and the spiritual. So there was that going on in the culture. And then they were the ones who got reinterested in things like the Shakespeare songs, the Hey Nonny Nonny songs, after all the sort of gravity of the 18th century. They were looking for playful new forms. And this is titled by Keats, Extracts from an Opera. So it may be that he was fooling with the idea of writing a libretto and that these were actually to be song lyrics. This one is called Daisy's Song. The sun with his great eye sees not as much as I, and the moon all silver proud might as well be in a cloud. And oh, the spring, I lead the life of a king. Couched in the teeming grass, I spy each pretty lass. I look where no one dares, and I stare where no one stares. And when the night is nigh, lambs bleat my lullaby.
I like that. I like what you say about it in the book. You could compare what you think it's officially supposed to be about with your interpretation of what it's about.
Yeah, I think I said that it was sort of, if it had a symbolic meaning, it was about having an earthy kind of imagination, different from either the sun or the moon, which play through the poem. But I thought that the line that interested me was, I look where no one dares and I stare where no one stares. So I thought it was really about being able to look up girls' dresses.
I figure you're right. Keats died when he was, what, 26 or something?
Yeah.
Like that? Did that scare you when you turned 27 and you thought, oh my gosh, I've already outlived him?
Yeah. I knew that he was, when I was 27, Keats seemed, and still does, way beyond my reach. But I certainly always, I marked it. You know, I still find myself marking those things. Well, Wallace Stevens was 55 when he wrote this. And luckily, there are enough American poets who kept writing when they were older that
That's
you can
right.
keep saying to yourself, Stanley Kunitz is 90, Czeslaw Milosz is 88. They were writing great poems in their 70s. So.
You know, it interested me. You write in the book that when you started doing your column in the Washington Post that printed a poem a week with some comments by you about each poem, you know, you needed to look for shorter poems to fit into the column, and also you needed to read a book a week to find a poem.
Uh-huh.
And so you started reading really quickly, and you realized, wait a minute, poetry isn't meant to be read that way. This is something I know I face. It's something that keeps me from reading a lot of poetry because I have very little time and I end up reading very quickly. And I bet a lot of people are in that predicament. And I wonder if you think that that is affecting how a poetry is read or even if poetry is read.
Yeah, I do. It does affect people. On the other hand, if people change their poetry reading habits, that the shortness of poetry, of some poetry, would be a reason for reading sometimes when you might listen to music or do something else. Because, or for me anyway, you can sometimes just sink into a poem, get into that part of yourself underneath the, you know, the sort of brain roof chatter and anxiety kind of quickly with a dive into a poem. And So one of the things I was hoping in doing this book was that, that you know, a poem a week that people could put up on their refrigerator with a magnet or cut out and clip and keep at bedside and read a couple of times might be a way of dealing with that problem, you know, that our lives are way too busy to have an inner life.
Right, right. We have some really good and very short poems that you include in Poet's Choice. Let me ask you to read one of them. This is a poem by Langston Hughes, which I believe is just called Poem.
Yeah.
What do you like about this one?
Well, I like its plainness. It tries to be just point blank plain. I also think it was written during a period when Hughes was trying to figure out what to do with the blues in poetry. How to adapt what's in it to the poem. Let me read this poem.
Great.
It's called Poem. I love my friend. He went away from me. There's nothing more to say. The poem ends soft as it began. I loved my friend.
So what do you think he's done with a blues
it
kind
sits,
of form in that?
You know, this is the kind of poem that poets call risky because it sits right at the edge of bathos, you know, which Wordsworth, who started this experiment of writing completely plainly, often got accused of. But if it were a blues lyric, you'd say, I love my friend, he went away from me. Oh yeah, I love my friend, he went away from me. There's nothing more to say. And the singer could draw it out so that you could hear the rhyme between me and say. The poem ends soft as it began. Oh yeah, the poem ends soft as it began. I love my friend. And you'd hear the rhyme of end, began, friend. When the singer does, in the way that Dylan, say, or Son House can make anything rhyme. So what he's really done is write a blues lyric, and he's taken out the second line. I love my friend, he went away from me. There's nothing more to say. The poem ends, soft as it began. I love my friend.
Robert Hass is the former Poet Laureate of the U.S. His new book, Poet's Choice, is an anthology of favorite poems by other writers. His latest collection of his own poems is called Sun Under Wood. Robert Hass will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Hass. He was our Poet Laureate from 1995 to 97. When he started his term, he began a syndicated newspaper column in which he published favorite poems by poets he admired. The idea was to put poems in an accessible place and to help create a shared literary culture. Those newspaper columns are collected in his new book, Poet's Choice, Poems for Everyday Life. We invited Robert Hass to read and talk about some of those poems. There's a poem I'd like you to read an excerpt of. It's by Thomas Sayers Ellis, and it's called View of the Library of Congress from Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about this poem before you read it, since we're not going to be hearing the whole thing.
I love doing this poem because I was working at the Library of Congress and stumbled across this poem by a young black poet who grew up in Washington, who was living in Boston, who had written a poem about going to Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School in black Washington, D.C., you know, that city that was a Jim Crow city while the government conducted its business right up to 1954, and for a long time afterwards was not much better than Jim Crow. And so here, this young poet was writing a poem that I thought was a poem about the distance between people and public institutions, among other things. So the title leapt out at me. So here's the beginning of the poem that will give readers a taste. View of the Library of Congress from Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School. A white substitute teacher at an all-black public high school. He sought me out, saying my poems showed promise, range, a gift. And had I ever heard of T.S. Eliot? No. Then Robert Hayden, perhaps. Hayden, a former colleague, had recently died, and the obituary he handed me had already begun its journey home from the printed page back to tree, gray becoming yellow, flower, dirt. No river. We skipped rocks on the horizon above ground zero from the roof of the Gibson Plaza apartments. We'd aim, then shout the names of the museums, famous monuments, and government buildings where our grandparents, parents, aunts, and uncles worked. Dangerous duds, the bombs we dropped always fell short. I love this picture of kids on a roof in Washington aimlessly throwing rocks in the direction of the great public buildings that excluded them. It turns out in the poem that his aunt works at the Library of Congress.
So it was actually closer than
yeah, he thought. A lot closer.
Yeah. My guest is Robert Hass, former Poet Laureate, and editor of the new book, Poet's Choice, Poems for Everyday Life, which is a collection of some of his favorite recent poems by other poets. You know so much about really short poems, I think in part because you're an expert on haiku. You've translated volumes of haiku. You've written poems inspired by haiku. And you reprint a few haiku in your new book, Poet's Choice. And there's one I'd like you to read by a poet named Issa. Why don't you read it first, and then
okay.
in a way it speaks for itself.
It does speak for itself.
Which doesn't mean we're going to prevent ourselves from having you speak about it, but first read it.
mm-hmm. Well, I'll read it. I'll just say one word. The haiku form required that the poem be centered in a particular weather. You wrote a fall poem or a spring poem or a winter poem, and there were certain set themes for those poems, snow obviously being one for winter. And Issa was a poet who was always figuring out new ways to deal with those themes by paying attention to what was actually going on. So this is a winter poem. Pissing in the snow outside my door. It makes a very straight hole.
Now, it's funny because I think we think of that subject as being something that contemporary poets might have taken up, but would have been unheard of to poets of an earlier era. Guess not.
Yeah, Issa was, of course, famous for a sort of earthy vulgarity in his poetry. And he was writing in the early 19th century. He's probably roughly a contemporary of Robert Burns or a little older than Keats. But even in the 17th century, there's a story, you know, that one of the disciples of Basho in the 17th century, who was one of the great, the great teacher and founder of the modern school of haiku, one of his students came to him and said, Master, is it acceptable to write about night soil in poems? And Basho said, yes, but you don't need to do it very often, which sounds like, when I first read that, I took it to be a kind of fastidiousness or prudery, that you should not mention body functions in poems. But I think probably he was exactly right, that you don't need to do it all the time because it's an easy way of getting attention. You know, one knows from contemporary poetry that it's, you know, in a way, the easiest thing in the world to write about bodily stuff in order as a way of getting quick attention.
Yes,
the nice thing...
Go ahead.
Yeah, the nice thing about this poem is its perfect matter-of-factness and also that odd little private curiosity. There's a wonderful passage in Coleridge's notebooks in which he is taking his chamber pot outside this cottage in the north of England to empty it, and he comes back and sits down and makes a little notation of the fact that the moon looked particularly beautiful reflected in his urine. That could not have gone into an English poem in the 19th century, but it could have gone into a haiku, and it reads in the notebooks as if it were a haiku.
So the advice that Basho gave was, okay, you can do this kind of poem, but you don't want to do it too much. it gets a little cheap. But
yeah.
that reminds me, one of the poems you have in your latest book, a poem of yours that I really like, is called Shame, an Aria, and it starts off with you in an elevator. You're standing in an elevator, basically picking your nose.
Right. No. You know how in literary criticism you say it, the speaker of the poem was picking his nose.
That's right. The speaker of the poem was picking his nose. And a couple walks in and you're really embarrassed and you uh-huh. put the offending finger in your pocket where it finds a lot of lint inside and so on and so on. And it ends up being this long meditation about bodily fluids and bodily functions and how much shame we have about them and how we're afraid, you know, it's going to prevent people from loving us and prevents us from liking ourselves. And I like the poem very much. I'm going to ask you to say a couple of words about it and why you wrote it, since you of all people know that it's okay to talk about this stuff sometimes and cheap to do it too often. What were you getting at?
Well, I think, you know, I found myself as I was writing this book thinking about the whole subject of things that couldn't be fixed. Maybe it proceeded from divorce after a long marriage. Maybe it proceeded from thinking about my own childhood. Maybe it proceeded from thinking about politics. I grew up in this school, went to this school that was, you know, a hospital for Indians so that the dying in great numbers of American, European diseases. So I was thinking about the irreparable, and at some point this circled around or circled back to, the body, the kind of plain versions of this, of all of the different places where shame and grief collide. And I wrote this, I think, as a kind of mad raving. A taste of it maybe would be, and I called it an aria because it felt like that, almost came out as a single sentence.
How about just the first few lines?
Okay, so this is shame, or the beginning of shame. You think you've grown up in various ways, and then the elevator door opens and you're standing inside, reaming out your nose, something about the dry air in the mountains, and find yourself facing two spruce elderly couples dressed like improbable wildflowers in their primary color, definitely on vacation, sports outfits. A wormy curl of one of the bodies, shameful and congealed lubricants gleaming on your fingertip under the fluorescent lights. And there really isn't too much to say as you descend the remaining two flights with them in silence, all five of you staring straight ahead in this commodious aluminum group coffin toward the ground floor.
That's wonderful, and so is the rest of the poem. Do you read that at readings?
Yeah, I do sometimes. My students, if they're around, will say, are you going to read your nose-picking poem? No, it's a serious philosophical poem.
My guest is former poet laureate Robert Haas. His new book of favorite poems is called Poet's Choice. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with former poet laureate Robert Haas. When he started his term, he began a syndicated newspaper column in which he published favorite poems by other writers. Those columns are collected in his new book, Poet's Choice. In your new book, you say that you started your weekly column because you wanted to give us back what we're losing, a shared literate public culture. What do you mean by that?
Well, I had two things in mind. One was I found myself while I was doing the poet laureate's job, reading around a lot about the history of American literacy. And it struck me that when poetry appeared regularly in the newspapers, which it did from about the 1820s to the 1910s, it coincided with the period when public schools were being formed and a massive literacy campaign was underway in America, a whole country of people, immigrants and people from rural English traditions where literacy wasn't expected if you weren't the landlord, were teaching themselves how to read. The whole country was teaching themselves how to read. And when they did, they shared a poetry in common. Poetry, oratory, stories were printed regularly in newspapers. So I was thinking about that. I had some feeling that newspapers are trying to look more and more like television, to look and feel less literate at a time when we need them to be more literate. So that was one part of it. The other part was, there was a wonderful essay by V.S. Naipaul, the Trinidadian writer who lives in London, who writing about Republican Convention. And he said he was listening to the oratory and it sounded strange to him and he couldn't figure out what it was. And he said after he listened a while, he understood that the reason that it sounded so flat, like white noise, was that it had no echoes in it. That it was language that did not refer to other language. That it was everyone was speaking out of a kind of bureaucratic tabula rasa. He said even Margaret Thatcher, not famous for her literacy, could say when she was going to get roasted in Parliament, the lady's not for burning. That there was a kind of echo chamber of shared language in public speech that made it rich and gave it resonance, and that American public speech had only a few slogans from movies like Read My Lips to give it any resonance at all.
Do you feel like when you were coming of age that there was a shared literary culture that you were part of?
Well, yes and no, because growing up in San Francisco, I grew up around, I was in high school when the Beat Generation was in North Beach. And there was poetry in the air. It wasn't public. It was, you know, it belonged to the same, for kids, same sort of underground thing that listening to jazz and rhythm and blues and early rock and roll did. But it was among us shared, and it felt like a live part of the possibilities of life.
Right. Well, we're just about out of time. I'd love it if you could leave us with a rhyme. Do you want to choose a few lines from one of your favorite rhyming poems?
Well, a rhyming poem. How about, how many miles to Babylon? 60 miles and 10. Can I get there by candlelight? Yes, and back again. Or here's one from the same unknown author. Hinks winks, the old witch winks, the fat begins to fry. There's no one home but Jumping Joan and mother and father and I.
These are children's rhymes, aren't they?
Yeah.
And do you know them from your childhood?
Sure.
And you still like them?
Yeah, like them more.
Why do you like them more?
Well, some of them get more mysterious to me the longer you live with them. This little poem seems to me, over the years, a great poem. It may be a kind of English country version of the blues. How many miles to Babylon? 60 miles and 10. Can I get there by candlelight? Yes, and back again. There's a wonderful poem by Amiri Baraka about Sun House that ends, it's all right. Looks like we're going to be here a taste. This poem has some of that quality. How many miles to Babylon? 60 miles and 10. Can I get there by candlelight? Yes, and back again. Helps a lot sometimes. Say that you can get back, you know. Get there and get back.
Did you like those poems when you were a kid, those rhymes?
Yeah, I did. I don't remember much about them. You know, I just absorbed them. And I loved reading them to my kids, which was the next time I came back to them.
Any thoughts on poetry you'd like to leave us with?
Well, I want to say about poetry and children's poetry that an elaborate, many-year study commissioned by the Department of Education on all the controversies surrounding reading recently appeared. Should phonics be taught? Should whole word method be taught? So on, all of these debates that are going on inside the education establishment about pedagogies for reading. And, what it turned out that the best way to make sure a child would learn to read is to read to them. And this comes back to the theme of poetry, literacy, and newspapers, I guess, that it turns out that if you want your children to read, to love to read, to have a pleasure for it, there's a fairly simple way to see that that's going to happen, and that is to take them on your lap every night and read to them.
Robert Hass is the former Poet Laureate of the U.S. His new anthology of favorite poems by other writers is called Poet's Choice, Poems for Everyday Life. His latest collection of his own poems is called Sun Under Wood. This is Fresh Air.